You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's Food Friday. For some people, it's the season of baking, which means stocking our kitchens with butter and flour and sugar. But hold on. Our next guest says we can hold the sugar and the things we might use instead of sugar and get great sweet flavors from fruits, fresh, dried, or frozen, and other ingredients. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you bake sweet treats, have you found ways to cut down on the amount of sugar or replacement sweeteners, or do what our guest does and try to use other ingredients, fruits, and other things to bring out their natural sweetness instead? Do you have questions about how to do this, maybe to make something particular that you love to make, you love to eat, but you don't want all the sugar? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Brian Levy is a pastry cook and author of the cookbook Good and Sweet. Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You were inspired in this mission in part by a mango. Could you share that part of the origin story?
I was. I guess about almost 8 years ago now, I was eating a really sweet mango, and it just struck me that I should be able to make a dessert out of this another sweet fruits that without having to add any extra sugar, because it was every bit as sweet as I would want any dessert to be. So I thought there must be a way to make desserts out of fruit without adding sugar to them.
And I want to make it clear here, you're not just saying replace sugar with honey or maple syrup or stevia or saccharin or whatever. You're taking that category out, right? What are you turning to instead?
Yeah. So, well, I call them sweet ingredients because I don't call my way of doing things, I don't call what I use sweeteners, because their only purpose isn't to make things sweet. But I wanted to seek out ingredients that had flavors that made sense in recipes, as well as bringing their inherent sweetness to make things. Obviously, we want desserts and things to be sweet, so we need that sweetness. But I also want the flavor that comes along with all the fruits and different kinds of flowers and nuts and things that I use.
And now, as you mentioned, Brian, this has been years in the making, and you're off the beaten path with a lot of the stuff you're doing. There have been a lot of experiments. I'm guessing there are some experiments that didn't pan out along the way.
Yeah, there were. So it was years of experimenting. Every recipe really was like a new experiment, because I wasn't working on just like a formula that of a single replacement for sugar. I had to approach every recipe as an experiment. And yeah, in the beginning, especially, there were things that didn't work out so well. Like, it was usually when I approached a new category of dessert, like cake or cookie or trying meringues. Meringues were a big failure. There are some things, one of the things that I learned along the way that was that there are certain things that you should use sugar for, such as meringue. Eventually, like I felt like I cracked some codes working with different kinds of ingredients and got a good collection of different categories of desserts to work out really well.
Well, let's get a taste of one of them. You've shared a few recipes with us. We've got them at wpr.org/foodfriday. Let's start off with a rosemary lemon shortbread. What goes into this? What did it take to make it work?
Well, this is one of the ingredients that was like a real revelation for me, which is freeze-dried sweet corn. So I use the things that, and in every recipe, after the head note, it has a little what makes it sweet section, so you know what's going into the recipe that is making it sweet. And for the rosemary lemon shortbread, there's freeze-dried sweet corn and date powder. Now the freeze-dried sweet corn it's really got all the flavor and sweetness of fresh summer corn on the cob, and all that flavor gets kind of concentrated when all the moisture is taken out of it through the freeze-drying process, and you know, but all of the nutrition is left in it, and it just has a lot more corn flavor than an ingredient like cornmeal or corn flour, the kind of stuff that we use for polenta, because that's actually made with a different kind of corn that isn't as sweet or flavorful. Anyway, so when I started using freeze-dried sweet corn, that was a really great discovery for me. And then the date powder, of course, is it's whole dates. It's called date sugar also because that's probably a more marketable term, but it's not actually a distilled sugar. It's just it's whole dates that are just blended into a powder. But yeah, so it's got dates, corn, rosemary, flour, butter.
Sure.
I don't, as much as I didn't want to use, as much as I have healthward leanings, I still use butter and flour. I have alternatives for these kinds of things, but I'm not trying to replace everything in a
Fair enough.
conventional recipe.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Brian Levy about his new cookbook, Good and Sweet. Baking delicious sweet treats, but without adding sugar or the common sugar substitutes, trying to get the natural sweetness out of delicious ingredients, often, but not only, fruit-related ingredients. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us in Newton. Rebecca, hi.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am really interested in this because I've been sugar-free now for over 5 years. I did have a lapse where I went back to sugar for a few months, but then I stopped eating it again. I don't eat any fruit either, though. So the ingredients that I use when I bake for Christmas and I make cookies, I make cakes, I make cheesecake, I use monk fruit, powdered monk fruit, which I get on the internet. It's not cheap, but it's a good sugar replacement from a fruit. And it has no calories and no carbohydrates. So I use that, and then I use almond flour because I don't eat carbohydrates much. But I have a cheesecake that is out of this world, and nobody knows that it has no sugar. I served it to many, many, many people. No one knows. They love it.
Rebecca,
So
thanks.
I was wondering what he thinks about that.
Rebecca, thanks for the call. I think monk fruit, that is one of the sweeteners you avoid, Brian, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, so that just wasn't the approach. That just wasn't the route I wanted to go in my. I looked at all those kinds of sweeteners, the sugar alternatives like monk fruit and stevia, erythritol, or however you pronounce that. The thing with those things was I just found that they were. I just wanted to use foods that like. We actually know what they look like and what their flavors are and where they come from. And I was looking for more of a whole food approach. And my goal wasn't necessarily to make things free of sugar because there is, of course, naturally occurring sugars in all these recipes. I just wanted it all to come along with something else, like all the fruit that goes into these recipes brings along with it all these nutrients, like namely fiber and vitamins and antioxidants. All these nutrients that are make the sugar. Well, first of all, I yeah, the more of like a in like a the philosophy kind of deal was that I just wanted it to be a kind of whole food approach. And with all those nutrients that come along with the fruits, it does change the way your body processes the sugar. So like it doesn't hit your bloodstream as quickly as a bunch of cane sugar does.
Thanks for that
But
call. And I wanted to ask Brian, in addition to like the health benefits of, cutting back on the sugar, obviously, can you talk about the flavor benefits? We're maybe tasting those ingredients that if we used them in the first place, would have been drowned out by that, whatever, half cup of sugar.
yeah. So like let's say the sticky toffee pudding, which is on the cover of the book. That was one of the first things I t tested because that's just always been one of my favorite desserts. And it's just the, it's kind of this brown, sugary, buttery, chewy, sticky thing that you wouldn't really think of not adding sugar to, but it does, the traditional recipe does have dates in the cake. So I just really amped up those dates and they end up kind of being the star of the show. And then there are things like in a fig crumble, I use in the topping, I use dried white mulberries, which are actually a relative of the fig. So they really complement the flavor of the figs and add to it, and just have the perfect texture for the crumble topping. So it was a lot of fun discovering new ingredients that I had never used before, like the white mulberries, and using things that I had used before, but in a totally different way.
We're talking to Brian Levy. It's Food Friday. His new cookbook is Good and Sweet, a book about baking with naturally sweet ingredients, often but not only, fruits in various shapes, sizes, and forms, instead of, you know, that half cup of sugar or common sugar replacements. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried doing something like this? Do you have a favorite pastry that is, you know, lower at least on the added sugar or other sweeteners? Do you have a question about how to make a particular kind of delicious treat in this way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've got a few recipes from Brian, by the way, over at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Brian Levy, pastry cook, author of the cookbook Good and Sweet. He's joining us for Food Friday to talk about his alternatives to using sugar in pastry making and dessert making. His challenge over the last bunch of years, not just cut out the sugar, but not just replace the sugar either. Find naturally sweet ingredients and do what we can with those flavors. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've tried something like this yourself, if you like the notion, you want his advice or inspiration to try to do something like this at home, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on another caller now. Doug is with us in Colfax. Doug, hello.
Hi. For the last few years, my wife has substituted half the sugar and pecan pie with honey from our own hives. I just wonder what your guests thought about using honey for a substitute for sugar.
Well, I love It's super locally sourced, Doug. That's fantastic. Now, Brian, I'm guessing, again, with your experiment, honey, I think, was mostly off the table. What do you think about that? And if you were tackling pecan pie, what kind of things would you try to do to make it sweet?
Yeah, so I didn't use honey in these recipes. I love honey, but it's not in terms of what it's composed of. It's not all that different from sugar, and it kind of a big thing of this was the challenge of seeing how far I could go with ingredients that weren't like near pure sugars, with which would include things like honey and maple syrup and agave nectar. First of all, when I want the like a flavor that's reminiscent of honey, I do use bee pollen in recipes in the book, which is what it sounds like. It's little pellets of pollen that are that bees collect and bring to the hive, and they kind of look like multicolored sprinkles and have a slightly sweet, but not as sweet as honey flavor. And just a nice floral honey flavor. And then I do have a pecan pie. I have a derby pie in the book, which is a pecan pie with chocolate at the bottom. And for that like gooey pecan pie filling, dates were really the perfect thing for that. They, you know, pureed dates are pretty much the texture and flavor of what you want that, you know, gooey filling to be. So it's mostly dates in the pecan pie.
Fantastic, Doug, and I bet you know where to find some bee pollen. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Marie joins us now in Eau Claire. Marie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Marie?
Well, I was expecting guests who are vegan, and I thought, well, what if I use some coconut milk and maybe some almond milk and some mangoes, and I think probably just those three things. I might have added sugar, but I'm not sure that I needed to. And I can't remember exactly what I did to the mango, if I just cut it into the boiling stuff or if we added it after we made the pudding, but it worked out really well. Maybe I used a little bit of tapioca balls. I should have written it down, but everybody loved it anyway.
Yeah, you should have written it down. It sounds really good to me. And the final product was a pudding, Marie, right?
It was, yeah.
Sorry, so Brian, go ahead.
Stirring it on the stove, yeah.
I was just going to say, the great thing about coconut milk, I use a lot of it in the book because it actually is sweeter than dairy milk. So it's a really helpful ingredient when you're trying to avoid adding sugar to things, because in addition to the nice subtle coconut flavor it gives, it is also fairly sweet.
All right, Marie, back to the lab and recreate that one. Thanks so much for sharing that with us today. Talking to Brian Levy on Food Friday. His new cookbook is called Good and Sweet Cooking, baking, I should say, without sugar in our desserts, but also without a lot of the stuff we would replace sugar with, getting the flavor of sweet ingredients, the fruits and more. Hey, let's check out, Brian, another recipe you shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday, the perfect currant scone. Tell us about this one.
Oh, yeah. So in the scone, really, it's just the right amount of dried currants that make up all give it all the sweetness that it needs. That's a pretty simple one to make sweet. And then I have some variations on that recipe. I have a chestnut flour currant scone, which chestnut flour is actually pretty sweet, and so I use that in a bunch of recipes. And when you when you add that to the scones, in addition to bringing a like delicious smoky chestnut flavor, it also sweetens it up.
Let's go back to our callers. Dennis is with us in Afton, Minnesota. Dennis, hi.
Oh yeah, hi everybody. Thanks you and your guest. I mentioned I'm drying apples today, and I use them in soup. I've been doing that for quite some time, or throw them alongside of a chicken in the pan or whatever. You know, just use them anywhere. But my real question is, your guest mentioned that you have the freeze-dried corn. I wonder if you do your own freeze-drying, if you have the equipment for doing that, and where you got the equipment if you do.
Yeah, no, I don't have the equipment for that. I looked into it, and it's expensive. But the good thing is that freeze-dried fruits and vegetables seem to be popping up more and more all over the place, like at stores where, you know, from anything from a health food store to Whole Foods to Target and Trader Joe's actually has really great prices on freeze-dried fruits. So, it's nice to hear you're drying apples, because that's a really great ingredient that I use in a lot of these recipes.
Dennis,
I do dry those on my own.
Dennis, thanks a lot. Enjoy those apples. Susie joins us now in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I might have told you about this before, Rob, but I have a recipe from the Chiquita Banana Cookbook for using bananas in pumpkin pie instead of sugar.
Oh, that does ring
really
a bell, Susie.
Good.
That, and I think I said last time, that sounds really good. And bananas are also in your arsenal, Brian.
Oh, they are. I use, fresh bananas, freeze-dried bananas. I have a banana pudding, like a traditional Southern banana pudding with that you normally would use the Nilla wafers in it, but I make what I call nana wafers, and the thing that sweetens them is I pulverize freeze-dried banana. So it's kind of like a, it's, you know, that's starchy and sweet. So it acts as kind of a flour and a sugar. And then in my pumpkin pie, I actually use to forget the last caller's name, but sorry.
Susie, yeah.
But that, no, the gentleman.
Oh yeah.
My pumpkin pie is one thing that I use dried apples in.
Oh, awesome. Susie,
but
thanks a lot.
That banana sounds interesting.
Definitely. Susie, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Brian, what's next in your pastry experimentation?
Well, I'm actually doing some research I'm not ready to go public with it, but I'm doing research for another cookbook.
Excellent. Well, Brian, thanks so much for sharing these recipes with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're talking to Brian Levy, pastry cook, author of the new cookbook, Good and Sweet. He joins us today to talk about that cookbook. Got recipes that substitute things like fruits and other sweet ingredients for added sugar and all of those other sweeteners that you might replace sugar with. Well, there's still time for you to do, well, a couple things. Let us know if you've tried things like this at home. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and share your favorites. With recipes and pictures, if available, unless you're just winging it, then you just tell us about them. And you could check out a few recipes from Brian. We've got them up at WPR.org/Food Friday. You heard about the rosemary lemon shortbread that's up there, the perfect currant scone, and there's one bonus one we didn't even get to on the air, the pistachio studded peach galette. That one sounds really good, too. I've got some frozen peaches around. That might be something I'll want to try. So check them out. Again, they're at WPR.org/Food Friday and share your own home experimentation online on the Ideas Network Facebook page. At the end of every week here on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll get recipes, advice, and inspiration for baking and cooking with all kinds of ingredients. That's on the air each Friday, or you can check out our archives anytime at WPR.org/Food Friday. Try out a recipe there and let us know how it goes. If you're gift shopping this weekend for toys, here's an idea. Go with the classics. And there are some new classics this year. Earlier this month, new toys were inducted into the National Toy Hall of Fame. Here's the class of 2022, just three new ones. The Masters of the Universe toys featuring He-Man, She-Ra, and the rest. The Light Bright, where you put those cool colored pegs into the light board and made cool pictures. Or you quit when you got frustrated because it took a long time and attention to detail. And the top, you know, the spinning toy, quoting the press release, the top is one of the oldest toys and an integral part of many cultures. There you have it. It's your holiday toy shopping list. Find the full list of Hall of Fame toys at the National Hall of Fame website. Toy news you can use. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. Do you consider yourself a nerd? Maybe you're a big superhero comic fan, or you love to geek out to Harry Potter fan fiction. Our next guest loves a wide variety of what we could call nerd culture, and she says it deserves the same level of cultural analysis and criticism that we usually think about for things that are, you know, more highbrow, fancy art house film or prestige television. She shares that love in a new book, along with a look at how nerd culture takes on things like race, sexuality, and mental health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you nerd out about? What are those movies, books, TV shows, comics, you name it, mean to you or add to your life? Do you feel like you're part of a community, a fandom for some particular pop culture? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maya Phillips is a poet, author, and critic at large for the New York Times. Her new book is Nerd, Adventures in Fandom, From This Universe to the Multiverse. She's appearing at the Wisconsin Book Festival tomorrow at 9 p.m. at the Madison Public Library Central Branch. Maya, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again.
Can you share your origin story a little bit? Where did you first start to love nerd culture?
Oh my gosh. It has always been a part of my life. I don't even know. I mean, even from when I was a child, from a very young child, I remember I was just watching like early anime. Like I remember I watched Speed Racer when I was still in diapers. Like I was watching early anime from elementary school. I was watching Dragon Ball Z and Pokemon, and I was into Harry Potter when it came. You know, it has always been a part of my identity. And it's interesting to see how it's become so mainstream now.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, but I want to get into this idea. I think this is really central to a lot of your essays here. We think sometimes, okay, yeah, the serious criticism we're going to do for the fancy stuff. This is like escapist entertainment. We don't really need to engage with it that carefully. Why is it important to you that we do that?
It's important because these fandoms reflect who we are, what we believe culturally, what we believe individually. And it, you know, like people, there's a reason why people get up in arms about the representation in their fandoms, or like how things are portrayed, the politics of it. If you look at these fandoms, you can see a swath of what we believe as a culture and what we value. And I think that's really important.
I think sometimes a reaction to this kind of look is, just given the way the internet works now, is I love this thing. And if you're engaging with it and you say something bad about it, you know, we're on opposite sides. There's this like us versus them sort of thing. You clearly, in a lot of the pop culture you write about it, you might see concerns and problems. We'll talk about that. And yet you still love the thing. How can we separate out that, you know, yes or no, us against them mentality?
You know, I wish there were a better solution than, guys, you just need to chill out a little bit. Because I do get it a lot. Whenever I write an article on a beloved fandom, something that I even love, like Avatar, The Last Airbender, I wrote about that and people were upset because I was analyzing it. And I think there just needs to be a better understanding that the reason why I'm analyzing it, the reason why I'm taking the time to think through these thoughts and to, you know, go through each episode or like sit through the movies once, twice, however many times, is because I do care about this. And I do care about how this art can be improved.
We're talking to Maya Phillips. Her new book is called Nerd, Adventures in Fandom From This Universe to the Multiverse. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself to be a nerd? If so, what for? Is there one particular thing you're really into? Are you a dabbler like me or really into a lot of different things like Maya? Tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You write about not just the, you know, the books and comic books themselves, but also you have an essay about fandom and how as things have gotten more mainstream, we've, I don't know, started to connect with each other and build identities in some ways around our love of nerd culture. How do we get there?
You know, it's really interesting. That's the fun thing to really see about fan culture. You know, I think it's something that we saw really early on with people who were Star Trek fans. Like they had that kind of really big community that was really active. And, you know, now we see it a lot more. I talk about people identifying with different houses in Harry Potter or different villages in Naruto. There's so many ways to relate to a fandom and like take that into real life in places where you might not feel as included as, you know, a person of color, a person with disabilities, a person, you know, of who's non-binary. That's why these fandoms are important. And, you know, it's great to see that in convention culture too, and how that's changed and how people react to gender bending, you know, doing different types of cosplay for different characters. That's really great.
You write about the treatment of race in a lot of different elements of pop culture. And there's an interesting, I think, question for people. Do we, in our science fiction or fantasy setting, do we try to, or superhero comic, do we try to talk about real world issues of race? That's one way to go. Or do we try to create a society that is outside of that, a utopia, at least when it comes to race, where we can get away from the bad stuff we have in our society? It's a tough question to answer, I think. What are your thoughts on that?
I think Black Panther is a really good example of that, that kind of addresses both sides of it. Because, you know, when we get to Black Panther, it's a very, Wakanda is very insulated, you know? They have been able to advance, they have all the technology, but they're hidden from the world. And they have this front that they're a third world country. But I think that it was really clever how the plot was created, that we have Killmonger come up as a person, as a Black American who was raised in the hood, and him coming to Wakanda and being like, you know, you guys have all these resources and you're not using it to help the other Black people across the world. So I think like that is a really good stand-in for a kind of ideological clash of what do we, especially when it comes to race and especially when it comes to like fantasy and sci-fi, all kind of genre works, like, are we actually representing an escapist fantasy where these people of color can just live freely, or do we engage with the real world, which is a part of our everyday experience?
One of my favorite elements of that you write about is time travel. When our characters go a time traveling, if our characters are white, we don't necessarily have to think about a lot. But you found some examples where Black people from the modern day went into, I don't know, Victorian England and places like that. How do you see that being handled?
You know, it's really disappointing to me because I watch time travel shows a lot. And one of my favorites is Doctor Who. And I see these characters and it's so easy to have the characters be white for that reason. Most of these characters in the time travel stories are white, or there's some kind of workaround so that they don't have to address race. But, you know, it's part of the Black experience. And if you are going to time travel, and if you're going to time travel in America, in Africa, in any of like the colonized parts of the world, that's going to be enslavement and the various indignities done to our race. That has to be part of the story. That has to be part of that character's arc. And to do that in a way that is respectful, but also makes sense to the story, it can be really difficult.
We're talking to Maya Phillips, critic at large for the New York Times, with us today to talk about her new book, Nerd: Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you define nerd culture? Do you consider yourself a nerd about lots of things in general or something in particular? What do the things you nerd out on mean to you? Are you part of a fan community for something? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Maya Phillips from the New York Times about her new book, Nerd: Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a favorite thing to nerd out on, call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Linda is with us in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hello. What? I'm wondering why we have to label people all the time.
As in nerd, for example, Linda?
Yeah.
Gotcha. Thanks for bringing that up, Maya. I mean, once upon a time, nerd was a negative thing that somebody called somebody who didn't want to be called that. This is one of those terms I think that's really been reclaimed. Could you talk about the label of nerd?
Sure. You know, and thanks, Linda, for your question. Yeah. I don't think labels are super important. And I think that's part of what I'm kind of poking fun at with my title. that, yes, nerd used to be something you would call someone who was involved in something a little bit niche, and it was a derogatory term. And now people will say, yes, I'm kind of nerdy, or like, I love to nerd out about this. And so we see how those kinds of labels can change and how people can embrace them depending on what is happening in the zeitgeist. And I think that what's important is not the label, but just the meaning behind it. And for me, being a nerd is something I just say to let people know that I am passionate about these fandoms, and I am proud to say that I'm passionate about them.
Linda, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Maya, that reminds me of your comment earlier about a lot of the things we're talking about here getting more mainstream. You talk in the book about being able to show up at a major comic book convention without a lot of advanced planning and getting tickets. Not something that could not happen today. Why do you think these elements of nerd culture became so mainstream?
I mean, it's funny because we were able to see that with Hollywood. I mean, Hollywood did pretty much all of that work. You know, you can see the shift starting with the Spider-Man movies, you know, the Sam Raimi movies. And then, of course, once the MCU got started with Iron Man, once Hollywood found out that there is an audience for this stuff and they can make these big hit action blockbusters, that they invested the money into expanding that into, and now we have all these television shows, we have all these different types of adaptations, we have, you go across every streaming service, you will find something that, you know, just a decade or two ago would have been considered a little too niche. So now it seems like people can come out into the open and say, yes, I'm very into this. And it can also invite new fans in who may not have encountered this before.
Let's go back to our callers. Liz is with us in Lyons. Liz, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Liz?
I remember her referencing Doctor Who, and I have two questions. Bringing on someone of a different race and gender, what do you feel like the repercussions would be? Do you think people would be very upset about it? Me currently, I did not like the current one and the previous male. I liked everybody before that, even going all the way back. And so I'm wondering, how can I break through to that as well?
Interesting, Liz. So this is the character, the Doctor in Doctor Who, an alien who changes form to be able to change actors over time, for those not familiar with the show. And there's a woman doctor still, I believe, the concepts of changing race or gender for that character.
Yeah, I think it's really, I was really excited when Jodie Whittaker was named the next Doctor. I think she is a brilliant actress, but I think that the writing changed in such an unfortunate way that there was an increased consciousness of addressing her as a woman and addressing, you know, race in new ways, because she has, or at least in the beginning, she had these multiple companions of color. And it just became we just moved too far in the opposite direction, where it felt like wokeness for the sake of being woke. And it felt like being educational as opposed to actually, you know, thinking about the story and thinking about creating an entertaining and experience that kind of, you know, had the same kind of imagination as the previous doctors. And a lot of people blamed it and said on the doctor herself, unfortunately, saying that this is why we can't have a female doctor, but it's not that. It comes down to the writing and being more conscious of, you know, writing these stories for women or people of color. You know, the next doctor was announced and he's going to be a Black doctor. And I'm really curious to see how those writers go back and address his race and are aware of it without making it a whole big deal. Because we don't want another token character. We don't want to have stories that feel tokenizing to the doctor.
Liz, thanks a lot for that call. Peter joins us now in Green Bay. Peter, hello.
Why, hello. Thank you for the presentation. I'm an unapologetic fan of many fandoms. I had a quick linguistic question. It may seem pedantic, but is there a difference between a geek and a nerd? Does that even matter anymore?
Peter, thanks for the call. Geek, nerd, I think that's been an argument argued many times, Maya.
Oh, yes, it has. I actually was thinking about that a lot when I was writing this book. I don't think it matters too much. I think personally for me, I consider a nerd a person who is into some kind of fandom like I talk about, like comic books, like sci-fi, like fantasy, you know, genre, niche genre. And I consider a geek a person who is into technology, you know, like and a kind of IT person or someone who might be kind of into gaming a lot or into computers. But that is my personal definition. I really think people use it interchangeably. People have their own personal preferences, but I don't think it's really based in anything anymore. I think just you call yourself what you call yourself. Like we said earlier, the label doesn't really matter. It just matters what your interest is.
Thanks for the call, Peter. We're talking to Maya Phillips about her new book, Nerd, Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. Back to your calls now with Tom on the line in Marshfield. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you guys today? I came to the Big Bang Theory about during season 3. I'd heard about it, but I'd never watched it before. And the minute I watched it, I was hooked forever. And I like the fact that they used science and humor and also had real scientists come on the show occasionally. And I was wondering what she thought about that.
Tom, thanks for the call. One of the highest profile TV depictions of nerdery, Maya.
Yes, I also was into the Big Bang Theory for quite a while. My mom still watches it when it's on reruns. And I did really enjoy it, that the references wove it into the conversations. They were pretty seamless. And my problem with the Big Bang Theory became, once I became more aware of it and once I was starting to watch it for a while, was the depiction of the male fans and the kind of misogyny that is baked into the show. And I think that is a problem in fan culture, of course. There's a lot of misogyny in fan culture. In a lot of times it won't be very inclusive of women. And I think that unfortunately, as opposed to the show reflecting that, the show also had that in its DNA. And I don't think that was fully intentional with the show. So I will still watch reruns occasionally, but I do find it kind of cringeworthy, unfortunately, sometimes, just the way that they talk about their relationships and their women. Like, these are kind of toxic guys. But as I said, I already see that enough at conventions.
Thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more caller. Chelsea is with us in Madison. Chelsea, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say I've always loved reading science fiction and fantasy, and I'm very happy that in the last couple of years we've been able to have more critical conversations about how women and people of color are depicted in these stories. But I've definitely avoided rereading some of my favorites for fear that I won't enjoy them as much anymore. How do you be critical of these stories while still enjoying them?
Interesting question. Yeah.
You know, it's really tough. It can be really tough. I think that you do kind of have to put your critical side to the side. If you can, like, if you really want to enjoy these things that cause, you know, that give you the sense of nostalgia that you enjoyed as a kid, that you know are problematic, I think you can have a moment where you say, okay, I know this is not great for this reason, but you can still move on and like go, you can reread it or you can rewatch it. And I think as long as you have that awareness, then that's fine. Like, these are all personal interests. These are all personal loves. And so no one will judge you sitting in your house watching something that you loved when you were a kid. No one's going to do that. I think it becomes a problem when we give more money to things that are problematic, when we engage in a public forum with things that are problematic without actually signaling that, you know, this is the problem with this, this is the problem with that. So as I said, enjoy what you're going to enjoy, and, you know, just keep it in mind that some of these things don't age well, and that's just the nature of everything. Even things today that are really popular, we'll find something that's wrong with them in the future. That's how it goes.
Thanks for that call, Chelsea. And Maya, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you again for having me.
That's Maya Phillips from the New York Times talking about her new book, Nerd: Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. If you want to listen back to this full conversation or hear any of the discussions we've had on Central Time, you can find them all on our online archives. Those are at WPR.org, along with a lot more. Articles from WPR's news department, podcasts, and live streams of WPR's two networks. And we're always happy to hear from you. If there's an issue you think needs more attention on the air, or if there are people working on it in your part of Wisconsin, we want to know about it. You can email us at centraltime@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to the director of the Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources in Wisconsin for guidance on how to navigate the challenges of housing for seniors. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.